Westwood One presents Two Chairs and a Microphone.
Checking 1, 2.
Here's your host, Paul Mercurio.
Well, here we are together again. Welcome to the show, everybody. It is Paul Mercurio, and appreciate you guys checking out the podcast. So I'm going to be doing something a little different going forward. Some folks have been saying, hey, what's going on with you? Let's hear about a little bit about what's going on with you and all that stuff and what you think about stuff and blah, blah, blah. So I am going to be doing some rants and little chats, whatever you want to call them. They'll be sometimes at the beginning of an interview, or it might be a whole episode if I get a lot on my mind. So we're going to be adding that to the show, spruce it up a little bit. Can you start with the idea that no one should put nuts in brownies, please? Chocolate cake and brownies, my favorite. I like the chocolate, cold milk. First of all, you don't have coffee with chocolate cake. Anybody doing that, you need to leave the country. I understand Russia's a pretty good friend of ours right now. I'm sure they'll take you in. You got to have cold milk, not tea, not coffee. Secondly, do not put nuts in brownies, okay? It just interferes. It's like you're on a highway, you're going 100 miles an hour, and then you put a speed bump when I bite into a brownie and start chewing and I hit a nut, okay? So let's just end that right now. I'm going to see if my local rep will sort of bring up a bill in Congress about that. Speaking of Congress, former Congressman Anthony Weiner pleaded guilty to sexting with a teenager, so he's going to be mayor of prison sex. That's what he's going to be. He's going to be congressman taking it in the ass for 24 months. Yeah, freak. How ironic. He's going to be able to work out and look at himself with giant men standing around him. Probably eating brownies with nuts in them because, you know, that's what you do to a prisoner. You send them brownies, but you put nuts in it. Not a cake with a file in it. Brownies with nuts. So here's the most bizarre thing that's happened to me in a while. I called Apple. You know Apple, the giant, technologically advanced center of the universe company. And I had a problem with my phone, so I called the 800 number, and they said, we can't help you over the phone with this. You got to go to a store or talk to somebody in a store. And I said, okay, can you transfer me, please? And the guy goes, no. I go, no? Yeah, no. I go, because you don't want to? He goes, no, I just can't. I go, what do you mean you can't? He goes, we don't have the technology to transfer the call. You don't have the technology to transfer the call? My iPhone is giving me a hummer right now. What are you talking about? Like, I have an app that'll allow me to physically transfer to the store. How do you not have that ability to transfer a phone call? What is this, 1950s? So I said to the guy, you need to have a meeting, because then I get crazy, and I told him, go have a meeting at Apple and tell people at Apple that's ridiculous, you can't. And I'm sure he's just nodding his head and giving the jerk-off sign to the person on the phone next to him. But I think I'm right. Am I crazy or am I crazy? You can't get transferred by Apple? I've got a phone that'll shoot x-rays and kill enemies and my phone does the... I can't. It's too much. All right, now, tell me if this is weird or strange. We had a dog, Rusty, Chow Golden Retriever mix. First of all, the dog found me annoying. Whenever I would walk into a room, he'd immediately get up and walk into another room, which I really thought was like, you know... And he'd give me a dirty look, like, I'd literally, like, not after 5 minutes, my foot would hit the carpet, and he'd look at me, get up and go, ugh, this asshole again, and walk into the other room. Then if I walked into that room that he was in, that he just walked into, he'd look at me and go, really? I just got comfortable in here. You understand the dynamic? You're in one room, I'm in another. I'm not a big fan of yours, right? So now I'm like self-conscious about the dog because the roles are reversed. Like, I'm the human, he's the dog. He's supposed to annoy me. I'm not supposed to annoy him. So I'm afraid to go to sleep near him. When he was alive, I wouldn't sleep near him. I was worried I was gonna wake up. He's gonna be driving me to the pound to get neutered. It's like how my wife's like, well, it was the sound of your voice annoyed him. I'm like, do I sound like sirens? Like what? Fireworks? Is that a vacuum cleaner? Well, how can my voice annoy him? So anyway, Rusty passed away recently. It was a heroin overdose. Yeah, I should have seen it coming. You know, he was lethargic, sleeping all day, licking his balls a lot, you don't probably, a lot of heroin addicts lick their balls. Makes you very flexible, the heroin. And the signs were all there, and I ignored it, so I take it on myself. No, he died of cancer. And no dog cancer research, huh? It's all about humans. What about the doggy? Can we get that going? That's all I'm saying. I mean, look, you got to take care of cancer in humans, but the dogs, you know, we'll walk them and pick up their shit. You can't put a little money toward a little cancer thing for the dog so he gets a little injection and, you know, goes completely bald, but, you know, says a lot of positive things going forward in barking voice speak. All right. So anyway, the dog's really sick one night, and we're like, okay, this is, went out for 3 months, and he was really sick, and we're like, okay, this is it. We're gonna take him. So we take him. We live in New York City. We take him to Midtown to this 24-hour clinic, and it's like 3 a.m. And we go in, and we said we think the dog's got to be put down, but we're not sure. She goes, okay, the tech, I'll get the vet, but it's gonna cost you $170 just to have him look at the dog. I'm like, what are you talking about? I might have the dog killed. What? It's not like, it's like I'm coming in with a car that I'm going to junk and you're going to charge me to have the mechanic open the hood and look at it. Like it's, she goes, no, that's it. I go, what if he just looks at the dog? She goes, no, you can just decide if you want to put the dog down. I'm like, I'm not a vet. I'm not wearing a tag and a green lab coat. Like what this is not my thing. Okay. I can't. Okay. So now I'm getting amped up over trying to kill my dog basically. So, and then they want to charge $350 to euthanize him. So we're looking at over $500 for me to kill a dog. I mean, I could get my car and it cost me about 30 cents in gas. I mean, it's ridiculous, right? So they're standing their ground. They won't bring the vet out unless I agree to pay the money or pay it up front. And I'm like, I'm not paying $520 plus tax. I don't know if there's tax on killing dogs. There should be, you know, why not? Help to pave the roads, help build little doggy parks. When they're alive, they're running around. All right, so I say to my wife, now it's like I'm at Walmart and I'm not going to buy the TV there. I'm going to Target. I'm going, we're not doing this. We're going to go find another place that will kill this dog for less money. I know that sounds like mean or whatever, but like I couldn't, I mean, I love the dog to death. Rusty was his name, but like, so we bring the dog home. You know, we're both really upset. We sleep a couple of hours, and we take Rusty to the ASPCA. And they charged, like, first of all, I started talking to him. I go, before we start, how much to euthanize a dog? Like, now I'm shopping to kill dogs. Okay, so, like, I'm price shopping, and it's like, oh, and I have a coupon, $10 off, and I get a free collar from my next dog that I adopt. No. So, and you know what they say? $85 sold. That's the number. That is the number. So I know it sounds weird that I refused to spend that money, but I felt like I was getting shaken down because they prey on your emotion. It's like, oh, this is going to be the best. It's like, well, you're euthanizing. The drug's the drug, right? It's not like a higher end drug. It's not like you're going to get like the Rolls Royce of drugs if you spend $520. You're going to get the same drug. With the thing, you know, they hit him with some propofol and then he fell asleep and then they hit him with another thing. And oh, by the way, propofol, my kid, it's exhausting when you have a kid. Any of you out there listening who have one know, and if you don't, you will understand. You worry about your kid 24/7. I love my son Alex to death, but you worry. And I'm tired of worrying. I need a break from it. So I've come up with a plan. 1 weekend a month, I'm going to knock my kid out with propofol. Not, you know, just so he sleeps for 48 straight hours. I know where he is. I'll have him monitored by a doctor at all times. Not the Michael Jackson doctor. I think he kind of missed the boat on that. And then at the end of the weekend, my kid wakes up. He's refreshed, ready to go to school. And I just spent 2 days running around, doing whatever I want, shopping to have my dog killed, you know, taking care of errands, maybe a strip club or two. You never know. All right, so there's other stuff going on, but those are the things that were really on my mind. Apple is completely screwed. You really should shop if you're going to kill your dog. Don't put nuts in brownies, for God's sake. It's un-American and whatever the last thing is that I just said, because I forgot. Now I'm tired. Now, my guest this week is Sandy Gallen. He is a mogul in the true sense of the word in Hollywood, manager, producer, agent, and had a hand in some of the most amazing talent that has come down the pike, going back to Barbra Streisand, Madonna. It's incredible what this guy's done. And I wanted to talk to him for a long time, and I did, and it was a great podcast, and he was on the show, and then he passed away recently. And I just wanted everybody to hear this again. If you have heard it, then listen to it again. I don't think most of you have heard it because it was on a different time. It was a while ago, and my podcast was in a different place, in a different network. So, you know, he got the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. He worked with Richard Pryor, Michael Jackson, Nicole Kidman, friends with Barry Diller, David Geffen, Calvin Klein, Donna Karen. Just produced major films, Father of the Bride, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So I wanted you guys to hear what a cool guy this guy is and the history of that this guy has and the number of stars that he's influenced and helped create. So enjoy that. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Hope you like the rant. If you've got something that's bothering you and you want me to talk about it on the air, I set up an email account. It's called PaulTalks1, the number one. My name, Paul, talks, plural, one, at Gmail. PaulTalks1 at Gmail. Send me some anything that's bothering you. I'll say your name if you want me to, and we'll talk about it on the air, and I'll read about it, read it, and we'll get people to hear. Maybe if I get it off your chest for you, it might be better. PaulTalks1 at gmail.com. Send in any comments, thoughts, things you want me to rant about for you, and enjoy Sandy Gallen.
I'm very, very excited to have on a legend in the entertainment industry, and I don't use that word lightly. He has been an agent and manager to some of the most amazing clients that you could possibly think of. Richard Pryor, Dolly Parton, Michael Jackson, Whoopi Goldberg, Mariah Carey. He's been a producer of Father of the Bride, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Just a really interesting man who's done a lot of really interesting things in this business. And I'm happy to introduce you all to Sandy Gallen. Sandy, welcome to the show. Thanks for doing this today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We are mutual friends of Carmine Minardi, who I think cuts both of our hair. And he is a good dear friend in New York City, where you grew up and lived some of the time. And I live, and Carmine is a become a fan of my podcast and said, you got to talk to Sandy Gallen. This is a really interesting guy who's had a long, long, colorful history in the entertainment business. And I'm curious, you know, you were a kid in New York, and I read a quote where you said, as soon as I could speak, I talked about having millions of dollars, knowing famous people, and becoming a star. As a kid, did you really just knew you wanted to do something in the entertainment business?
Yes, I always knew that I wanted to be in the entertainment business and that I wanted to know stars and that I wanted to be in Hollywood and walk down the streets in Hollywood and have stars know my name and recognize me.
Wow.
And supposedly, I talked about it when I was 2 years old.
Now, what did as a kid, do you remember sort of anybody in particular, stars that you were taken with, that just like, you know, that really, did you gravitate toward musical stars through film to film?
Anybody
star?
Who was famous.
Yeah.
Anybody who was famous. And then as I grew up, I wanted to be a singer. But if I was going to be a singer, I wanted to be of the stature of Elvis Presley, Barbra Streisand, or the Beatles.
Well, so you aimed pretty high. That's good. That's great. And did you sing for a while? Were you pretty good? I mean, did you go out?
I thought I was great.
And what kind of music, what did you say? Were you doing standards? Were you doing rock? What were you doing?
I was doing pop music, and I was offered a contract at the very time that I was going to college, and my mother was putting her head in the oven and killing herself that, you know, I was not going to go to college and I was going to be, you know, taking this contract. So I had to go to college, and I put the singing on the back burner. And then when I graduated college, it was the time of the pretty boy, which I definitely was not. You know, it was Frankie Avalon, Fabian, Ricky Nelson, and Paul Anker, and all of those guys. And I would say within 2 years of graduating college, I represented almost every single one of them.
How did you go from sort of wanting to be the guy to representing those guys at such a young age? How did that happen?
Well, my cousin was the only one I knew in show business. His name was Ray Katz. And the way that you started in show business then, almost all the time, was in the mailroom of an agency. And most of the time, it was in the William Morris agency. And I was waiting to get a job at the William Morris agency. And they strung me along and strung me along. And finally, they said, "We're sorry, you don't have a job, and we're not giving you a job." Well, I remember my mother, my brother, and I all crying in this little kitchen in Forest Hills. It was like, you know, death had fallen on the family.
So you're having this conversation in, at home, and it's house. So what do you do next? What's what
okay?
Happens?
I get a I get into the training program at Gimbel's department store.
Famous department store in New York City. It was Macy's and Gimbel's, competitors, right?
Exactly. And I have a very fast rise. In like 3 weeks, they make me the manager of like the third and fourth floor. And they call a meeting of the third and fourth floor early, like 15 minutes early. And they're going to announce that I'm going to be the manager of the third and fourth floor. And I get a call from GAC, which was General Artists Corporation. General Artists Corporation at the time represented all the singers and comedians.
Now, let me ask you something. You're at Gimbel's. Do you feel like you've given up on your dream? How do you feel?
No, not at all. I'm waiting for GAC to tell me that they're going to let me be the first trainee. And I'm praying that they're going to call me at any second. The day, the night I go home, before they're going to announce to the staff at Gimbel's that I'm the new manager of the third and fourth floor, I get this call from Larry Lewis, who is the runner of, you know, sort of the personnel department. GAC was the second biggest agency.
And for people listening out there, and it's still to this day, what people do is they get jobs in the mailrooms of these big talent agencies, and they work their way up the food chain and learn every aspect of the business, ultimately becoming an assistant to an agent and then an agent, right? I mean, that's generally how it works, right?
Yes. And they still do it, except today there's such competition. You have to be, you know, like top in your class from Harvard.
Right.
And
right.
have a doctorate from, you know, a master's degree.
Right.
And the jobs are coveted like crazy. It's very, very hard to get these jobs. And, you know, they're, you know, 300 applications for every one of these, you know, jobs. And right. they still start at no money. I remember that I started at $50 a week.
Wow. And what were you making at Gimbel's?
Oh, they were just going to raise me to $350 a week.
Wow.
That was my new salary. And when I told the guy, listen, I don't think you're going to be able to understand this, but I have to turn you down, and I'm starting a training program. And I just got the call last night, and I'm going to have to turn this job down. Mm. And I explained it to him that I was taking a job for $50 a week. He could not fathom what I was talking about. He said, wait a minute. You're going into the mail room to deliver mail for $50 a week, and I am offering you a job to run the third and fourth floor of Macy's for $350 a week.
Ah, that's so funny.
Do you have to have your head examined? I mean, the guy just could not believe it.
Right.
Well, I was the happiest person that ever lived.
Yeah. And did you, so you knew that that was your path and there was nothing taking you off of that path?
Is
that you just knew. And then yeah. what was,
I mean, do you know what GAC was?
I know generally, but I not in
okay. GAC, represented all of, Nancy Sinatra, Frankie Avalon, Paul Anka, all of, you know, the Shirelles, all of the black groups, all of the Teresa Brewers, the Patti Pages, all of the stand-up comics.
Mm-hmm.
Were they
a precursor to William Morris, or was William Morris a competitor? Like, wasn't William Morris big in that day?
William Morris was the biggest agency,
right?
In the variety end, GAC was bigger.
Mm-hmm.
The person I went into the mailroom,
mm-hmm.
I would say. Maybe 3 days after I got in the mailroom, I went to typing and speed writing school,
mm-hmm.
which took about 6 weeks.
Right.
When I finished, I looked around and I pointed out to myself the agent that I wanted to work for.
Who was that?
I talked to his secretary, and I convinced her to quit. She didn't care if she worked for him, or she worked for another agent, or she worked at GAC, or she worked at an advertising agency. You know, it's a job.
So let me ask you this. You're how old at this time? 23?
Two.
Where do you get the balls to go over to another agent's secretary or an agent say, I want you to work for me? Like, where does that come from? Is that influenced by your parents? Like, what did your parents do for a living? What did your dad do? And did some of that come from them? I mean, because that's a lot of chutzpah, as they say.
Yeah, but, you know, you're 22 at that age, and she's probably 21, 22, 23. And yeah. at that age, you make friends, you know, in 5 minutes with people.
Yeah, that's true.
And I made friends with her. I said, look, I really, really want to work for your boss because he runs the television department in New York, and he books all the talent on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be where I would be able to meet all of the talent.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the talent that I was really interested in at the time.
And that talent would be a lot of the musical acts.
Yeah.
And how was she receptive to that, or what was how
she was totally receptive to it.
That's great.
She's fine. And she set up a meeting for me to meet him.
Yeah.
And I went in, I met him, and I said, look, his name was Tony Ford. I said, I graduated Boston University. I very much would like to be your assistant and start a training program at GAC, which there is none here. MCA had one. MCA was just disbanded. And a lot of the agents from MCA came over to GAC. Mm-hmm. So they were going through a lot of turmoil.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that William Morris, you know, and he was a fairly young guy. I mean, he was not all that much older than me.
Right.
He was probably, I don't know, I would say at the most 10 years older than me. Right.
So you get access to Tony Ford. You tell him that you want to start a training program.
And I want to be the first trainee, and I want to be his secretary.
Now, where did you get that? That's a very clever idea. Where did you get that idea to do the training program concept? Like, was that your way in your mind, the way to kind of get him on your side? Or that's very creative.
No, I just wanted to start the training program, and I wanted to be his secretary because I figured that's the way that I would learn everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was receptive to it. He said, okay, I think when I said to him, look, I will be your secretary, and oh my God, the maid just let the dog back in. I said, I will be your secretary, and I will be your 24/7 slave.
Very smart. I'm sure he liked that.
I know you have to cover the Sullivan Show all day Saturday and Sunday. I will be there. I will do it for you.
Ah.
And I will do all the stuff that you don't want to do. I'm a fast learner. And I will make your life really easy. And he said, okay.
Wow.
So I did it. Okay, now, you want to see how lucky somebody can be?
Yeah.
Okay, so I can't remember how many months I was working for him. But I developed a great relationship, maybe 8 months. I spent every Thursday night, all day Friday, Friday night, all day Saturday, Saturday night, all day Sunday, until the show was done at the Sullivan Show.
Mm.
And I would stay with whatever stars we had on the show. He would come over for an hour or two.
Uh-huh. And give people an idea, who are some of these stars that we're talking about in the day? Because the Sullivan Show, this is at the peak. I mean, this is one of the biggest shows in the history of television. This was not at a time when there were
400 cable channels. There were three major networks, and this was the show that everybody watched.
This was the show that everyone wanted to be on.
Right.
Everybody.
It changed your career. It was like what the Carson Show would do for comedians and acts.
And I also did the Carson Show.
Oh, wow.
I did the Carson Show, the Gary Moore Show. You know, there were not that many shows on. Right.
And who are the clients that you're taking care of, who you're bringing on the show? Just give people an idea of who we're talking about.
Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet.
Mm-hmm.
Diane Carroll.
Wow.
Paul Anka.
Nice. So these
Nancy Sinatra was when she had these boots made for walking.
Oh, yeah. So you're there Thursday through Sunday, basically living at the theater and sort of becoming the guy there.
I became very, very friendly with Bob Precht,
mm-hmm.
who produced the show, and he was Ed Sullivan's son-in-law. Mm-hmm. I became friendly, believe it or not, with Ed Sullivan. He just took a liking to me.
What was he like? Was he an interesting guy? What was he like off camera?
Exactly what you would think he was like on camera.
Is that right?
Yeah, he was exactly the same.
Kind of a little interesting, a little odd perhaps, a little abishy.
A nerd.
Yeah, there you go. Uh-huh.
He was
a journalist.
He was a nerdy guy. Right. He would say things that you, oh, my God. I became very close with Phyllis Diller.
Is that right?
I mean, I'd have to look at a list.
Mm.
We're talking, believe it or not, almost 50 years ago.
Wow. And what do you, in retrospect now, 50 years later, because it's hard to see this when you're in it. What do you think? You're obviously making contacts, and you're obviously moving toward your goal from when you were 2 years old of being with and around and part of a famous group of people. But what do you think, as a practical matter, you're learning as an agent during those nights that you're spending at the Sullivan Theater?
I'm learning how an agent should relate to a client.
Mm.
How they should represent a client, how they should handle a client on a television show.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm learning, you know, the relationship between an agent and a star.
I'm learning it
basically at the top of the music and the comedy world, you know.
And that wasn't stressful for you? I mean, you know, I'll liken it to baseball. You know, you start out in the minor leagues and you play there for a few years and then you go to the big leagues. And you kind of just walked out of college and right into the big leagues with very little, like, learning experience, and you're learning on the job, as you just said, with the biggest stars in the world. Did that make you nervous at all? Not at all. Really?
Loved it.
Well, that's
and
the key.
It was the largest agency of variety clients. So whether it was Woody Allen, Peter, Paul, and Mary, Simon and Garfunkel.
Wow.
Whoever, Dusty Springfield, whoever it was, I had entree and became friendly with them.
Was there any... go ahead.
The great break that I had.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it was less than a year in this job. Tony Ford is on vacation. Roy Gerber and Norman Weiss, two of the agents in the personal appearance department,
mm-hmm.
are trying to sign this boy band in London. They call Tony Ford. He's not there. Mm-hmm. They say, we don't want anyone else to know this.
Mm-hmm.
We are an inch away from signing the Beatles.
Wow.
We want you to go over and meet with Ed Sullivan and Bob Precht and Jack Deb and to make an exclusive deal for the Beatles on the Sullivan Show.
What? Oh, my God. That's amazing. Now, at this point, you must be tingling, right? You're on Yeah. Forest Hills, right? A kid from Forest Hills.
I'm dying.
Yeah.
I'm dying.
Wow.
And I did.
Now, let me understand something. If you go make that deal, that helps. That helps the agency get signed the Beatles. Like, I guess if you turn around and can say to the Beatles manager or whatever, look, we got to get you on Sullivan as an exclusive, that would seal the deal and get the agency on board with them. Is that right?
Yes.
So you go over, and how is Sullivan and his producer receptive to it, or was it a tough sell, or what?
Oh, yeah, it was very tough. It was very tough. It was like, you know, a one-minute meeting.
Well, you know, I didn't know. I mean, Ed was kind of not the hippest guy in the world, and I didn't know if he'd want somebody like that on his show.
Everyone in show business knew what was going on with the Beatles.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was, put it like this, it was not a hard sale at all.
Right. Now, this is before Shea Stadium, right?
Yeah.
So you go over, you have that conversation, you make that happen,
right?
And what happens next? I mean, I assume you're with the Beatles at the appearance?
Yes.
Wow, unbelievable! What was that like?
Unbelievable moment in my life, picking them up at the airport, you know, being with them at the hotel, being with them during the weekend while they're on the Sullivan Show, just being able to tell my friends that I went to high school and college with that I'm with the Beatles, you know.
Yeah.
The whole thing is surreal and unbelievable.
Yeah, and they're roughly the same age as you at the time, right? So they're more peers in that sense.
Exactly the same age.
And that probably helped in a way, right? Did you guys sort of have... Look, I interviewed Paul McCartney for my podcast. I'll send you the link and you can listen to it. I interviewed him several months ago and couldn't have been a nicer guy.
Nicest guy, right?
Oh, my God. You know, he was such a mensch. He was gave me his time, and we talked about... I like talking to people about their process and what they do and how they got to where they are. And so we talked about, you know, him in the days in the Beatles, and he tells this story that the four of them were, you know, before they hit it big, they were traveling around England, you know, doing these little gigs, and they lived in a van and slept in a van half the time, and somebody broke the window in the van one night and stole something, and they had to sleep in the freezing cold, like all huddled together in what he calls a Beatles sandwich. And he reminisced fondly about those days, and he was such a nice guy. And were you able to bond with them a little bit because you were similar in age? Did you find you had anything in common with them, even though, you know, you're from America and they're from England?
I didn't become close with them.
Right.
You know, they were on the move working every second. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like we were going out at night and hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, they were on a schedule every minute.
Wow.
And
were they okay? Were they okay with that at that age? I mean, you know, you're 21, 22.
Oh my God. They were enjoying it and having the time of their lives. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
they were having a ball.
Wow.
But it wasn't like that we had time, you know, to sit around and just bullshit or, you know, let's go to DJ Clark's and have
right.
a cheeseburger.
Right. So after that appearance that night, and it was as nuts as it seemed in the footage that you see, you were in the theater, that the girls were just, I mean, those weren't setups, those weren't props. I mean, those girls, that was all real. Those are just people off the street that you got to be in the audience and bang.
Oh my God, yes, it's all completely, yeah. totally, 100% real.
Yeah, yeah. Just incredible. And did you, so at that point after that, they're now members, they're now a client of the firm, agency, I assume, and were you sort of responsible for them whenever they would come to America, or what was the relationship going forward?
No, just really on the Sullivan Show.
Uh-huh.
Roy and Norman were responsible for them, and they were very, very, very coveted by their manager. He mm. was with them every second.
Brian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brian Epstein was always, you know, around and always with them.
And did you get involved with their visit to Shea Stadium at all? Were you part of that? And
yeah, I mean, I went, but I wasn't really. Look, I was brand new. I didn't even know the concert business at all.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
At that time, I would say I didn't know anything about anything. I was just learning the television business.
Mm-hmm.
I was smart enough to figure out, develop relationships, you know, with as many stars as you could,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I had developed relationships with, as I look back now, I developed close relationships with Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet, who were very big stars at that time,
mm-hmm.
Paul Anka, Nancy Sinatra, Frankie Avalon, Florence Henderson, they made me a junior agent
mm-hmm.
right away, and the first week I signed Richard Pryor.
What?
Tiny wow. Tim, Dr. Joyce Brothers,
Jesus,
and Cass Elliot.
Oh my God! How did you get? What year is this when you signed Pryor?
How did I do it?
How did you do it, and what year was that when you signed Richard Pryor?
I think 63.
So he's just coming up. And did you work with Woody Allen? Because you mentioned Woody Allen earlier.
No, I just said if Woody Allen.
If were, he had, yeah, I got you.
You know,
yeah.
Were on the Ed Sullivan Show, I would meet him and I would spend the weekend with him.
Right. So how did you come to know Pryor and start that relationship and get ultimately sign him?
I walked into the Cafe Agogo.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw him perform, and I just thought, oh my God, this guy is unbelievable. And I kept going to see him,
mm-hmm.
and we just developed a very quick, close friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And I signed him to the office and got him on the Merv Griffin Show. And got him on Irving Mansfield's, I think it was called Talent Tonight or something. It was a talent show.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard just started taking off.
What was his act like when you first started to see him at the Cafe Agogo? What kind of stuff was he talking about?
Basically the same stuff that he talked about for many, many, many years. There was the children's play that he did.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with Richard's material?
Yes, I am, yeah. So he was doing that back then, okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And he did the stuff about his father. He did the stuff about his grandmother's whorehouse.
Right. And was he doing was it Hambone? Was he doing those yeah, he was doing all that. Wow.
Yep.
Interesting. And you just sensed, was it the material or the presence? Like, this is what I'm fascinated about.
Everything. As,
it was just something he just emanated from the stage.
Everything that he did, and I thought, set him aside and, you know, made him a star that mm-hmm. separated him from everybody else.
All right, that I want to get to something with that. You've worked with amazing people, like I said, Whoopi Goldberg, Michael Jackson, Neil Diamond, Barbara Streisand, Richard Pryor. Is there something in those stars, in that category of people, that exists that doesn't exist in the people that aren't in that category? Is it an essence? Is it work ethic? Is it raw talent? Like, is it just the it factor? Do you see a common trait in all of those big stars?
It's the it factor. It's something unique and something different that each one of them have.
But unique and unique
a different thing in each one of them.
Right, but unique
not
and different.
The same. It's something. It's that undefinable quality mm-hmm. that separates them and makes them different from everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something you can't label. It's just, it sets them aside from everybody else.
Right. Right. And, you know, you were working with a lot of musical acts and now with a comedian. And is there any difference in terms of working with one versus the other? Did you have to
yes.
approach it? And what was the difference?
Each one is totally different. Each one is completely, completely different. I'll try and give you an example by giving you the simplest thing. Let's say an appearance on The Tonight Show,
mm-hmm.
Which is the simplest thing.
Mm-hmm.
Dolly Parton is a great guest on a talk show.
Why is
she
that?
She has a fantastic, fantastic, natural, comedic gift of gab. She's totally comfortable in her skin. She's very funny. She thinks fast. And she loves people and loves talking. And comes off great doing it, doesn't get nervous, and is perfectly at home doing it. Another person gets uptight, gets nervous, clams up, and is a horrible guest on a talk show. You should not put them on a talk show because they come off bad. And they don't make fans when they're on the show. So why should they do it?
Right. Right.
They should stay off those shows mm-hmm. rather than go on them.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody has to be handled differently.
And in handling these people,
Were there ever any episodes that stand out as funny or humorous or just a good learn, a teaching lesson for you? You know, an odd negotiation, a middle of the night incident, anything, whatever it might have been, where you just look back and go, "Wow, that was pretty crazy, or pretty interesting, or pretty funny," with anybody that you worked with, or you know, whether it was the people.
Oh God, I'm sure thousands of incidents. not that I can remember or repeat one of them.
Yeah,
at the minute, you know what I mean?
Yes,
of course.
And did you then move over to management from agency over to the management side?
Well, what happened was I became the head of the television department in New York. And the board of directors decided that if I could sign all of these people that I did in music and comedy, why couldn't I do the same thing in the motion picture department in California?
Mm-hmm.
So they asked me to move to California. I guess it was 2 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And take over film television with the idea that I would then go into the motion picture department.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. And I hated the film television department. Hated it.
Why?
Well, first of all, I was dealing with actors that were working by the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not... it's funny, I was just watching The Godfather. Jimmy Caan was one of those actors, and it was before he was a star.
He was one of your clients.
He was one of the clients of GAC out there.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that I did was I wanted to meet every one of the clients that we had so I knew who they were.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I had been representing at that time Diana Ross and the Supremes and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? The absolute biggest music and comedy stars in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I'm moving to California, and I'm representing Joe Schmo, who I don't know who he is, and neither does anybody else.
Right.
And I'm reading these horrible weekly episodic television shows.
Mm.
And I'm walking into casting directors' offices that don't even look up, you know, to say hello when I walk in.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, oh, my God, this is not for me.
Yeah.
And I say to myself, all right, give it 6 months. And I give it 6 months, and I hate it. Hate it.
So now you want to get back. You want to get back to New York and do music?
No. I like California.
Yeah.
But I think, wait a minute. The most financial important department in the agency business is the television packaging department.
And explain to people what that means is basically if an agency can represent the creator, writer, director, and say producer and the star of the show, that's packaging it under one umbrella, and that's a really good deal for the agency, right?
Yes, and then you sell it to the network. and you get a commission on the entire package.
Right. Now, where do you learn that part of the business? Because you really hadn't done much of that when you were in New York. Is that now, what are you, 25 at the time? 27?
Yes. 28?
How old are you? Okay.
25, 26.
And now that's another part of the business you got to learn. And how did you learn that one so fast?
I had gone to all the packaging meetings in New York City. And I learned a lot about it. And I became quite friendly and close with the guy that ran that department in New York. He was actually, I would say, my boss.
Okay.
When I became the head of the variety television department.
Mm-hmm.
I was the head of that department, and that department reported to the packaging department.
So you're six months in and you hate it, but you also know that the money in these agencies is coming out of the TV department, so you decide to stick it out and it just starts to work itself out.
I just went to him and I said, look, I hate being an agent in the film television department. I understand that there's no room for me in the variety department, but I can't stand it, and I'm going to have to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, what would you want to do? I said, well, I would want to run the variety department here and be in the packaging. And he said, all right, so then we'll work that out.
Mm.
I said, well, how are you going to work that out? He said, we'll work it out, period. Don't worry about it. We'll work it out.
And
he did. I came in the next day. He said, all right, what if you, would you co-run the variety department with the person that's running it? I said, well, he's going to have a heart attack. He said, I'll take care of that. And you will work with me in the packaging department.
Mm. That's great.
Yeah.
And who did you work with on the acting side that you got a kick out of, that you really enjoyed working with, or who you didn't enjoy working with? I don't know if you want to speak to that, but at least who you did. Were there relationships that you developed and really enjoyed having, and were there moments with certain people where it was just too difficult?
You mean when I became a manager?
Well, manager or agent, working with actors on the acting side as opposed to the musical talents that you were working with. Were there any actors in particular that you really gravitated to personally, had a good relationship with, and had some interesting experiences with, or that you didn't have good experiences with?
I can't think of anyone I did not, anybody that I had a bad experience with.
Mm-hmm.
I had good experiences with Whoopi Goldberg.
Mm. Now, were you managing Whoopi or repping her as an agent?
No, managing.
And when did you start working with her, and how did you come to work with Whoopi?
Someone called me, and they said they saw this one-woman show at the Dance Theater Workshop, and they thought that I should come to New York to see her because they thought she was very special.
Mm.
And I flew in. I saw her. I ran into a friend in the street who put a joint in my mouth. And I took a hit of a joint, which I never did when I worked, ever.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and I saw the show and I thought, oh my God, this is impossible. This girl can't be so brilliant. So I thought, I don't know if she's so brilliant or it was taking a few hits of a joint. So the next night, I called Steve Rebell, my brother, my sister-in-law, Calvin Klein, Burt Bacharach, Carol Bayasega, a whole bunch of my friends and in New York.
And that first name you mentioned was the owner of Studio 54.
Yeah.
Wow. So you took all these heavyweights to see her?
I took everyone the next night with me to see it.
Yeah.
And, of course, I didn't smoke a joint, and I saw her, and I brought everyone else. Everybody flipped out. I was 100% sure. And I, you know, started representing her. And Sam Cohn and I got Mike Nichols to direct and do the show as a one-woman show on Broadway. And, you know, she got Steven Spielberg's, what was the name of the first movie?
Steven's first movie?
No, Whoopi's first movie.
I'd have to look it up, but I can't. I'll check it right now. You keep going, and I'll let you know. I can't remember.
And you know,
not Sister Act, not that one.
No.
And did you? What was the plan when you sat down with her? Like, was it to go right to movies? That was clear. She did great characters in that one person show. And
the one-person show, she was beyond brilliant.
Yeah.
Beyond brilliant. I mean, people just, you know, fainted. And it was to make her a brilliant actress, you know. And to, you know, she had never done a movie and she had never done a television show.
Mm-hmm. And was there any adjustment to get her to that place, like to be able to pull that off? Because that's a big thing to carry a movie when you haven't really done much. Was it The Citizen or The Color Purple was one of her?
The Color Purple.
There you go.
I mean, I'm sitting here thinking blue.
You knew it was blue. A color.
Right. And I'm sitting here thinking blue.
Well, you were closer than I was. I didn't know. So, and again, you're sort of learning as you go. How often would you turn to others to confirm your instinct? I know that night you smoked a joint and you were concerned, but were you generally solitary in your gut knowing if somebody was a good find?
It was the gift that I thought God gave me.
To see talent.
Yes. To see talent and houses and be able to know what to do with them.
Yeah. It's a pretty amazing thing. And do you think, my gut is that because you were so passionate and in love with it from a young age, that you just absorbed it all and it just informed you in your decision making in a way that you can't get by going to school for something.
Yeah, look, you know, people think, I guess it's really egotistical or, you know, how can you say that? But I think that it's really a gift, you know, that God gave me to be able to look at a talent and say, this person has it and this person doesn't have it. And I have been wrong very, very few times.
Is that right? And when you were wrong, what generally, was there a common reason why you were wrong?
No.
It just depended on the situation.
I can't tell you how many times I've been wrong. I'm serious. I've been very, very, very blessed and lucky about that.
Who else have you, that we would know that, you know, you saw at a very young age and jumped on board with? Early on,
Mac Davis. I saw him sing in a backyard with a guitar.
Really?
And 3 or 4 years later, he had his own television show.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's a guy out of the world of country. That's a whole different animal in a way, right?
Yeah.
What about Michael Jackson? I know you worked with him. What was your involvement with him?
I managed Michael for 8 years.
And what time frame was that? Was he out of the Jackson 5 at that point and, you know, on
yes.
his own?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So he was a young man at the time.
Yeah.
And how was he to manage? How was that? Was that seemed like it would be a big chore because he's so talented. There's so many different things you can do with him. Like, what was that like?
Interesting. Interesting. Every day there was something very, very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Look.
Yeah.
Michael was a genius.
Yeah.
He was different than anybody on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And he was more talented than anyone on the planet.
What was his process? I'm not looking for stories about, you know, him, how if he was kooky or whatever. I don't care about that stuff. I'm interested in process. Was he a dedicated writer? What was his creative process like in terms of coming up with some of this amazing music? Would he sit for months at a time and work and then get into the studio and cut it? Or would he sort of work over a period of time? And how did this inspiration come to him?
He would go in the studio and bury himself in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And he would just record and record and write and record and write and record. And you didn't know what the hell he was putting down. And it would evolve into a song. And it was on the vinyl and in his head. And all of a sudden, it would become a record.
Mm-hmm.
And he would know what he was doing. And I guess his engineer knew what he was doing. And I guess the person that was writing the song with him, if he was writing with someone, they knew what he was doing also.
Mm-hmm.
But he would spend hours and hours and days and days and weeks and months. And all of a sudden, all of this recorded material would turn into songs and records.
And would he'd always have a producer. I know he did a lot with Quincy Jones. How was he very collaborative in those relationships, or was he pretty much singular-minded and knowing what he wanted, and the producer was there more to execute his vision?
It was different with everybody.
Yeah.
And it was different degrees with everybody. In other words, with Quincy, it could be different degrees of collaboration going from 1 to 10 with Quincy.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes he could be totally, completely collaborative with Quincy, and sometimes he could totally excommunicate him. You know what I mean?
If Quincy didn't, or producer didn't agree.
He could go from completely embracing somebody to leaving them in the lurch.
And was it a whimsical thing, or was it justified in your opinion?
I'm sure in his head it was totally justified.
Right. It usually is. That's what human beings do, right? And was your job at that point to sort of, that's one of the many hats you wear as a manager, to kind of make sure the process gets done and to accommodate what the client wants and needs. But sometimes you got to be a no person, right? And tell the client that they're not right. What is that moment like for a client manager relationship? What's best for the client kind of thing, you know?
You mean to referee between him and who he's working with creatively?
Yeah. I mean, you know, that happens from time to time, and managers have to step in and say, look, to the client, it's best if you get this worked out or side with the client. What do you do in those situations as a manager? Because that's one of your roles, right?
Every single situation becomes different. And Michael knew creatively what he wanted. I would just like him to deal fairly with people.
Right. And did you enjoy sort of, I mean, was that a big task because he was so talented and he could do so many things that there were a lot of plates to spin with him as a manager? Like, was his business all consuming when you were managing him for you?
I don't know the answer to that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I guess you could let Michael become totally 100% all-consuming if you wanted to.
Mm.
He could.
Yeah. And so when you start, you know, you're also starting to produce films, and you produce Father of the Bride, the remake with Steve Martin, and Do you enjoy that aspect of what you were doing at the time, which, you know, is a different role than managing and agenting, and it seems like a natural fit for you based on everything you had done up to that point. But in producing the different TV and film that you'd done, was that a fun experience for you? Did you enjoy that?
Yes, I didn't get that involved on a day-to-day producing of the movies, really.
Mm-hmm.
I more or less ran the company and put them together and made the deals and helped promote them and package them, but I didn't really produce them on a day-to-day producer. I was more of an executive producer.
Executives and packages, yeah. One thing I wanted to ask you about Richard Pryor, we talked about him and, you know, early on that you worked with him, and you worked with him for a while. How long did you work with Richard for?
Long time.
Yeah.
I was his agent. Then he disappeared up north for a long time. And when he came back, he wanted me to manage him. I remember when my secretary said, Richard Pryor is on the phone. My body went stiff.
Why? You just never expected to hear from him again? Was that
it? Oh, my God. I didn't know. No, I knew I'd hear from Richard sometime. But, I mean, when I was, you know, dealing with Richard on a day-to-day basis, you know, I can't tell you how many times I got Richard out of jail. And oh, my Lord. He,
for,
you know,
what? Well, I mean, you know, some of it, a lot of it's public. We know. Was it, they catch him with drugs, getting in a fight? What?
I got him out of jail for beating the guy up at the desk at the Sunset Tower, I think it was, the hotel he was checking into, and he punched him in the eye and broke his glasses and blinded him. I got him out of jail for the Basin Street West. He was on stage and some lady wasn't laughing. I happened to be there that night, and he said, lady, that's not funny, you don't laugh. And he continues with his, you know, stand up a little. Lady, what's the matter? You don't think that's funny either? And he walks, you know, back and forth on the lip of the stage, and she's not laughing. He says, "Lady, what's the matter? That's not funny either." Continues, goes back to her, say, "Lady, there's nothing I can do to make you laugh. Maybe this will make you laugh." And he pulls down his zipper, pulls out his stick, and he pees all over her face. And he says, "Now maybe that'll make you laugh." Of course, the cops came. I had to go get him out of jail.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, Richard was a handful. So when she said, "You'll never believe who's on the phone, Sandy," Richard Pryor went, "Oh!" And so secretly, I sort of managed him. But I told him, you know, I said, "Richard, I will always love you. I will always answer all your questions. You can always call me." And I was like the only white guy he ever trusted.
Why do you think that? Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I mean,
come on, you must know because you're a straight shooter.
We had a very, very close relationship. I guess before he ever made it.
Mm-hmm. And were you able to pull him aside after he pisses on a woman's face or punches a guy in the eye, and the next day over coffee at breakfast say, "Richard, what are you doing? You got to pull back. What's
of
what?
Of course. And Richard, are you crazy? You're going to wind up
in some fucking cell. Right. And what would he say to you? Why was he doing this stuff? Was it drug induced? Was it the booze and the drugs? Was it just a rage? He had an anger in him? Like, why was he getting into this trouble?
All of the above.
Interesting. Okay.
All of the above.
Yeah. Well, I'm a comedian, so I know that we're our own worst enemy sometimes. And I know you can have 6,000 people in a theater, and if one person isn't laughing at you, you focus on the one person that's not laughing. Every comedian will do that. I know that feeling. And were you able to help him kind of channel his demons or harness his demons as life went on? Were you able to kind of help him with that, or do you ever think he came to terms with that?
No. Absolutely not.
That's funny. Well, listen, I got a couple more minutes with you before we have to jump. I want to talk about, because you made reference to it, you are in this stage of your life doing amazing things with homes. You buy homes, you decorate them, renovate them, design them, redesign them, and sell them. And there's a great piece in you in the an Architectural Digest in the March issue about you, and you're doing this for Calvin Klein and Barry Diller and just a whole host of very, very big names, and also people without not such big names. Where did this come from, and what in your experience in the entertainment business informed your ability to do this? Is there something that you were doing as a producer, manager, agent that makes you good at this? Because it seems like it's a form of producing in a way.
I always loved doing houses. Mm-hmm. While I was managing and doing television and movies, I always was building houses. Mm-hmm. And I used it sort of as a meditation. Mm-hmm. I used it to get rid of stress.
Mm-hmm. Keep your mind off of stuff and keep your mind busy with something else, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I do the same
thing.
And
while I was in business, I did somewhere between 48 and 50 houses.
Mm-hmm.
Lived in every one of them and sold them.
Mm-hmm.
And people used to ask me to do them for them all the time, and I said no. And after I stopped doing show business, Jeffrey Katzenberg, many years later, asked me to help him with the house, and he said he wanted to pay me to do it, and I said, "That's ridiculous. We've been friends too long." He said, "Really? When you did movies for Disney, why didn't you say you wouldn't charge me? He said, what is the difference? And I said, you know, you have a point.
That's hilarious. That's a really good point.
I thought that was great. He said, you know, why did you charge me for Father of the Bride?
So
I did the house, and then Jimmy Iovine asked me to do one. And then David Geffen asked me to do one, and I've been doing them, and I love it, and it's turned into a business. And I call myself an executive producer of the houses, and I love doing it, and I do it for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, I haven't had anybody that hasn't been totally thrilled.
Well, you got to. People need to get this issue or go online and look at it, because there's a photo gallery of some of the houses you've done, and it's absolutely beautiful. And one of your trademarks is these sort of plank, dark, sort of old board kind of floors, which is one of your trademarks, along with a lot of white fluffy towels. I noticed in a lot of your shots, and it's really tastefully done, but very warm, and at the same time. Crisp, clean. Just a taste that you developed over time, or where did that come from? What were your influences in doing this?
I would just say it's something that's developed over years.
Yeah,
it hasn't really. You know, you mean have it? Did it come from seeing something in travels or in books or magazines?
Well, this is why I wanted to do this interview with you, because you're the guy behind the guy, right? And the world doesn't know a lot about a guy like you, and they should, because who we just talk about? We just talked about the Beatles, Whoopi Goldberg, Richard Pryor, Dolly Parton. These are all names that you brought to the world in some way, shape, or form, and found when they were nobody. And now, and you answered the question why you're good at it, because it was just in you. You're good at it, and I think the same thing probably applies to this house design thing work that you do now. That you're just a very interesting, talented guy with sort of this.
Well, thank you.
Oh, no, I mean it, with this innate ability to sort of, I look at these pictures in Architectural Digest, and I'm like, it looks like a guy who's been doing this for 60 years. And you haven't. You've been doing
it. I have.
Well, on the side, but still, it's pretty amazing.
I've been doing it on the side.
Well, it seems like you're really good at things, because you only do things that you're passionate about. And I think that comes through. I mean, I was a lawyer and an investment banker on Wall Street, and I left to be a comedian. And I did it because I was passionate about it. And it was, you talk about your parents, your mom putting her head in the oven, worried that you weren't going to stay at the department store. And my mother had the same reaction, like, you're going to leave being a lawyer to be a comedian. They do a lot of drugs in the clubs. And I'm like, well, Ma, they do more drugs on Wall Street than they do in comedy.
Where
clubs.
Are you from?
I'm from Rhode Island, Providence, Rhode Island. I'm Italian kid from up there. And my mother has a small furniture store, and my father put floors in for a living. And I went to Georgetown Law School in D.C., and then I ended up in New York City doing merger deals for a big law firm and then a big investment bank.
Right.
And in the middle of that, I started writing jokes as a hobby. I don't know why. And then I saw Jay Leno perform at a private function one night. And I went up to him and I basically said, I have these jokes and I don't know what to do with them, but you can have them. And he took them and he said, okay. And the next day he called me and he said, I read your jokes and you write well and they're clean. And I go, I need material for the Tonight Show monologue. I'll hire you to start writing jokes for me. And I did. And then the next week he did one of my jokes on the Tonight Show. He called me, paid me $50 for this joke. And it was the most powerful thing that ever happened. It was the most, you talk about just something in you wanted to do this entertainment thing. A light switch went off and I became just completely enthralled with performing and doing comedy. And so I get that the passion makes you great at what you do. That's really kind of how I see it with you.
And
that's
how long did you do stand-up?
I'm still doing stand-up. I'm a stand-up to this day, and I go on TV shows, and I'm an actor, and I produce TV shows that I've created. I've just created one right now that we're about to shop. We're going to take a round to shop, a TV show that we created that Carmine actually came to see me shoot. We just shot it last week in New York City and at a live venue downtown at the Village Underground, which was right around the corner from the Cafe Wa. So I'm producing my own TV projects, which we're trying to sell now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah, it's great. So I just wanted to say I'm really glad that you did this, and I hope you enjoyed it. But I just a really fascinating conversation with you, and I hope people enjoyed it because you're a very interesting guy who's really had a lot to do, very influential in bringing major talent to the forefront. So I'm glad people get to know you a little bit through this.
Well, good luck with your stand-up and your television shows and all your
Thank
things.
You. And congratulations. I know you recently married your longtime partner, so congratulations on that. I hope you guys have a nice long life together.
Thank you very much.
All right, that was Sandy Gallen. How cool is this guy? He was amazing, and he's going to be missed. And again, I just wanted you guys to hear him. And what a cool dude he is, and just what a crazy, unbelievable career he's had. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Follow me on Twitter and Facebook, and we'll see you next week.
A Westwood One podcast production.